Thank you, Peter.
Good evening. Hello. This is Michael Ronson. He's a guitarist that works with me a lot.
Get yourself sat down.
We have a band on a bit later for this, but we'll do some solo things first if we can. Slowly. Anybody who's seen me before knows that I don't do mini gigs, and this is one of the few exceptions. So we're going to start slowly till we get the hang of it again, because we're not too used to it. The first song is called Fill Your Heart, and it's by an American gentleman called Biff Rose. Can I have something to drink? Cute. Okay.
Welcome back to Album to Album. I'm Arslan Mohammed. In December 1971, a young postman named Alan Johnson, living in Slough, newly married and a new father to boot, got slammed sideways by David Bowie's intricate masterpiece, Hunky Dory. For the one-time mod and lead guitarist of the area, an impoverished Beatles devotee with ambitions of fame and stardom that would definitely make him the next Paul McCartney, David Bowie's new album perfectly captured that zeitgeist and set the mood for the turbulent decade to come. It was at once part of, and simultaneously light years ahead of, Alan's world of record shops, gigs in smoky clubs, long hair, flares, platforms, the last train home. In fact, Hunky Dory served as a clarion call for a new generation in which Alan dreamed of being a part. Well, it's funny how things turn out, isn't it? Alan Johnson never became the next Paul McCartney. Instead, having left school at 15 after a childhood of trauma, poverty, and struggle, he ended up being the Home Secretary, arguably a somewhat lesser achievement of being the next Paul McCartney. After leaving school, stacking shelves in Tesco's, he had become a postman and joined the Union of Communication Workers. He became General Secretary in 1992 and in 1997 was elected Labour MP for Hull West and Hessle. His political rise was meteoric, and in the end, he held 5 cabinet posts under Tony Blair and Blair's successor, Gordon Brown, including that post of being Home Secretary. Perhaps understandably, after 20 years of being at the sharp end of the political fray, he stood down from Westminster in 2017, garnering respectful tributes from across the House, and in general, being acknowledged as one of the finest parliamentarians of his day. Now, I can't really think of many other politicians of recent times who could honestly say of their childhoods that they've never forgotten that emptiness and craving for food. There's much, much more to his life than the extraordinary circumstances of his childhood, and if you want a fascinating story of determination and endeavour from the point of view of a dyed-in-the-wool pop fanatic, you really should get hold of the 3 books of his memoirs, each named after a Beatles song. So there's This Boy, Please Mr. Postman, of course, and The Long and Winding Road. His most recent book, In My Life, a Music Memoir, covers his life in music, with fond recollections of the artists and the songs that have shaped his life over the years. In the book, Alan has a lot of praise for Aladdin Sane, and that's what I guessed he might want to talk about. So I invited him onto this podcast, and in the event when he replied to my invitation in the affirmative, it was actually Hunky Dory that he asked to discuss. So off to Hull I went on a sunny day to meet him at his offices near the waterside, and you can actually hear a few seagulls here at points. And he was very friendly and open, and although a little bit pushed for time, hence the relative brevity of this edition, he was incredibly entertaining and illuminating on Hunky Dory and his own memories of music and what he was doing in his life at that time. So join me and Alan Johnson, and I hope you enjoy. So Alan Johnson, thank you so much for joining me. It's an absolute pleasure to be up here in Hull with you. And so you're very familiar to us from your political career, latterly as a very successful author with your memoirs. What else is taking up your time these days since you stepped down from Parliament?
Well, still writing, because I'm writing a novel now, so I'm into fiction for the first time. And I do some broadcasting. I did a radio documentary the other week. Do some telly, bit of telly, some stuff I do locally for the NHS. but actually the writing, I mean, it's, as I think Dorothy Parker said, the art of writing is the art of applying the arse to the seat, yes. You know, and just doing it. So that's kind of working day is kind of at least 4 hours slaving over a blank piece of paper and then hoping the next day that what I've put on it is readable. So that's the main thing. And I really didn't want anything to interfere with that. So I had lots of offers, as ex-cabinet ministers and politicians do, of going on this board or that board. But I didn't want to do that. I didn't want to do that because it would have taken me down to London, and I'm up here now. You're in Spiders from Mars country here.
Of course, yes.
The Spiders from Hull is really what
exactly
they should have been called.
Ronson's from Hull.
Ronson, Woodmansey, yeah. And Trevor Boulder.
Oh, they're all from Hull?
All three of them were from Hull.
So, of course, that's why you're here in Hull.
I came for Bowie, yeah. I don't think Bowie ever came here, actually.
No, he didn't. I think his dad was from Yorkshire.
But there's a club here called Spiders, which is after the Spiders from Mars. And there's a memorial not as good as it should be to Mick Ronson. It's a stage in the park here, the Mick Ronson stage, but it actually should be a statue.
He was
a council worker here, not just a grave digger, as they say, but a municipal gardener.
He was,
up here, and played with Woodmansey and Boulder in a couple of bands around Hull, and then, just as a coincidence, I think it was Woodmansey met Bowie, and... Bowie was looking to recruit. He said, well, I've got two mates you might want to hear from. So they really are. And in City of Culture in Hull, 2017, we were UK City of Culture. One of the great events was the recreation of the whole album, Ziggy Stardust, by the Spiders from Mars. Well, dead, unfortunately, but there was one still alive then. And it was a great event at the City Hall, and all dressed up and went through, did all the tracks off Ziggy Stardust. Yeah, it's a great event. Thing I was writing about in my life is that us baby boomers had an important living in real time, this social history of music. We were there at the birth of rock and roll. We were there, you know, through Skiffle. We saw me as a 13-year-old listening to the Beatles and, you know, suddenly... There were kids writing their own songs, two working class kids writing their own songs, not dependent on Tin Pan Alley. And the fact that we'd never troubled the American charts with British pop music before, suddenly the Beatles number one, number two, number three, number four, number five, and number six. That whole era was so exciting to live through in real time. And of course, Bowie was part of that. And the way we listen to music as well, this is an important part of social history. In the course of writing that book, you know, just... talking to some people, younger generation, just reinforce what I already knew. Kids are listening to the Beatles now all the time, and they're listening to Bowie's, and they're listening to Bowie's early stuff that we're going to talk about. And nobody else, I mean, I don't think they're listening to much Presley, but he didn't write his own songs, kind of thing. It was a...
He's more of a showman, isn't he?
More showman. And that was the route that people who became famous in pop music for a while would get. Tommy Steele, you know, was the great British rock and roller, and then of course the natural progression was to go into musical.
What happened to Tommy Steele?
Yes, still alive. Is he still still alive and kicking? There was important birthday. It must be about 85
90 now,
but
he was the great white working class hope for a while, wasn't he?
Yeah, the lad from Bermondsey, wasn't it?
Exactly. So they used to, I remember the very early reviews of the Beatles pointing to Tommy Steele, saying, here's someone who can follow in the steps of Tommy Steele.
That's a bit like the Alan Partridge gag, that Wings were the band
the Beatles could have been. But coming now to this album, now, when I got in touch with you, you got back to me and said you would like to do Hunky Dory. And that slightly surprised me, because having read your fantastic music memoir, for some reason I thought you would want to talk about Aladdin Sane. Just because you had some wonderful anecdotes from around that time. You were head of the communications?
No, I was a postman. I ended up as head of the communications. I was a postman.
There was a time when I think you said there was a postman who was trying to wear a lightning...
Lightning flash
in his face. And if you'd been in charge, you might have been a bit more lenient on it.
I would have been lenient, Ziggy Stardust had an enormous impact because of Starman. That's in the book. Because everyone swore that Mick Ronson kissed David Bowie.
Yeah.
We didn't, because nobody had video machines. Right. But this soon became a myth. He put his arm around him and they sang, and you know, in those innocent early 70s, suddenly this was this was scandalous. And it was also a brilliant song, Starman. And then Aladdin Sane, yes, that incident. I'd have loved to, I was a Bowie freak, raising three kids on a council estate in Slough, a huge council estate called the Britwell Estate. So I was 20, 21, mad about Bowie. Well, when Aladdin Sane came out, I was about 22, 23. And I'd have loved to have put that slash across my face. And I'd seen that kid do it a few years earlier, before I was a union rep, and get sent home.
Right. You're not delivering the mail like that.
Well, you can imagine him knocking on the door. You know, with a recorded delivery at 7 o'clock in the morning. Some old granny opening the door and collapsing. this guy with a lightning bolt. But that's how Bowie got to you. You know, you wanted to be a part of all that. But actually, Hunky Dory was my main introduction to Bowie. I'd listened to his eponymous. I followed all the kind of stuff. Read the Record Mirror, read the Melody Maker, read NME. I knew what was happening. And Bowie was already being talked about in the mid-60s when that first album.
You were aware of him. You were very much a mod. And
was he, by the way. Exactly, he was very much a mod. Although the mods wouldn't have danced to Laughing Gnome, I doubt. I mean, that's the trouble. Yeah. That kind of Anthony Newley phase was a bit strange. But nevertheless, he was a singer-songwriter, you know, and they were still few and far between, you know. There was something about him. There was an appeal about him. I missed out on The Man Who Sold the World, but I loved John, I'm Only Dancing. I mean, I'd heard that, and I thought, I mean, that bass line, which is by Trevor Boulder, that is such a terrific bass line. But really, I would say that, I mean, people talk about Bowie's Aladdin Sane phase and his Thin White Duke phase and, of course, his Ziggy Stardust phase, but there was a Hunky Dory phase. I thought of Hunky Dory in the way I think about his later phases, that he... You know, that long hair, which I copied and emulated.
Did you really have
There was no makeup or anything.
Long,
like that. Well, my hair got curly like his got curly when it got long. And there's a photograph of me actually in the third book in my hunky dory phase, you know, standing with my two little daughters trying to look very much like Bowie with that phase. and of course, at that time, you wouldn't have frightened the kids. There was no flashes across the face. There was no Ziggy style. There was no pantaloons or anything like that. There were very big flares, if I remember from that album cover. But then, what was this, 1971? So the Beatles had finished in 70. 71, we were kind of listening to Crosby, Stills, Nash and Young, and most things were wafting across from California. And the British scene was kind of getting into glam rock and all that. This album was just amazing. Talk about a game changer. You stuck that on, and you just heard changes, and you were just blown away, as you would be today. I mean, the bit in between that I'm missing, of course, is Space Oddity.
Yes.
Because, you know, here he was on the scene with that eponymous album, then he kind of off the scene, and then suddenly in 69, in the week that Apollo 11 was landing a man on the moon, and a week, incidentally, where me and my first wife and our two children then moved from the slums of North Kensington to a council house in Slough, on the day that the Stones had their concert in Hyde Park. We were going to go to that because we weren't
July
far away.
3rd?
It was July 69.
Yeah, just the day after Brian Jones died, wasn't
it?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. And they released the White Doves.
All the White Doves.
Something like that. But we missed that because we were in a little removals van. You had one day, you had to move. This was us moving to a place with indoor bathroom, toilet, front garden, back garden. I'm afraid we had to miss out on the Stones. But then at the end of that week, on the Friday of that week, out came Space Oddity. And linked absolutely to the zeitgeist, because it hadn't just been Space Odyssey, the film, the previous year Stanley Kubrick film, that grabbed everyone's imagination. You had the moon landing happening. And as I say in the book, when I was watching, as everyone was, Neil Armstrong on the black and white tellies, I was a postman, so I had to get up early and deliver. So I'd watched it for most of the night, grabbed a couple of hours sleep. But as I was walking around in the morning delivering mail, in the front rooms, the black and white tellies were still flickering. People had stayed up all night, were still watching. But the soundtrack to that, to me, when they showed that amazing film, and he was, that amazing footage, and he was saying, you know, small step for man, giant leap for man, to me it was, "Can you hear me, Major Tom? Yes. Can you hear me, Major Tom?" I mean, it was such a wonderful idea to release it on that day. But once again, as I say in that book, that record will live on and on. And whenever you hear it, it sounds just as fresh and strange and otherworldly as it did originally. Yeah. You know, most stuff dates, if you listen years later, Space Odyssey, I don't think will ever date. So for me, a long gap, 2 years, 71, hunky-dory. Wow, this is a great artist.
So you had a young family. Was that when it was the postman strike? Was that
Yes. 7 weeks.
Yes.
So we didn't have a lot of money. So I was 20. My youngest son had just been born, January 71. He went on to have a career in the music industry, by the way. And I...
Jamie. Yeah.
And I got this 7 week paternity leave, courtesy of the Union of Post Office Workers. Now, nobody has all-out strikes like that anymore. The last big one was the miners' strike. And with no strike pay from the union, you could claim some benefits then for your children, not for yourself, but for your dependents, because I had three. My youngest son had just been born. I actually found that what I was getting was sort of, it just went decimal then. It was 50p more than I was earning for a 48-hour week with the post office, which is why I was going, reputation as a militant, let's stay up.
That's where it comes from.
Yeah. But that was very kind of a big defining moment in my life. But I didn't have loads of money to splash around buying records. You know, we kind of had to agree with my wife. We were going to shell out for an LP what we would be buying. So mainly I was trying to listen to the stuff on the radio and buying albums. Cat Stevens was another big influence on me. But Bowie, Hunky Dory, was not just my favourite Bowie album, but, you know, in my top five favourite albums.
Really, of all time.
Of all artists.
And that's really saying something, because you have got some very
There'd be Blue in there, and there'd probably be three Beatles albums.
Blue, Hunky Dory, three
Hunky
Beatles
Dory,
albums.
I'm
not too far off you.
Yeah.
Hunky Dory is a really fascinating one, because when he started recording it, he didn't actually have a record deal. He started demoing these tracks, and then, you know, they were shopped around. RCA Records heard those demos and were like, all right, yeah, you know, you're onto something here. Signed him up. Yeah. And so he started recording it around June 1971. And we get these songs which are just fascinating. Now, you just mentioned now he was this very mercurial character around the London, you know, live scene. And there was the debut album, there was the Space Oddity album, there was The Man Who Sold the World. All of these were interesting forays into different styles.
Yeah.
But with Hunky Dory, I think around that time the vogue was very much singer-songwriters, right? Yeah. So especially the West Coast singer-songwriters, people like James Taylor and so on, were, you know, really coming to the fore. But here, well, I think this is very much a singer-songwriter album. It's really weird. It's a really weird album when you hear what he's singing about.
Different genres made it quite unusual, and really weird because he references the people that have influenced him. You know, Dylan's.
Yeah.
In there, Andy Warhol, of course, is in there, and changes style almost to do, and so, you know, homage to the Velvet Underground in
Queen Bitch,
the Bibbity Bobbity
hat, yes,
satin and tack,
yeah,
Bibbity Bobbity.
Although there we see kind of like the whole kernel of glam rock,
you've
got that real Eddie Cochran like three chord riff. And then the lyrics are all, they're very kind of sexually ambiguous. And this is a theme that runs throughout the album. They're very cinematic. If you listen to the way he's doing it, I'm up on the 11th floor, I'm watching the crucible, I'm down here. I'm very filmic narrative that goes through there. And I have a theory. In Hunky Dory, we've got Bowie's career and his future career in a nutshell. So many of the themes that he'd go on to explore.
Especially with the changes.
Changes, right. Changes. I mean, Changes is that generational thing. I think Changes is a song about, look at the 60s generation now fading. The Beatles split up, the Stones are, you know, sort of like elevated into rock dinosaurdom. Look at that generational shift going, the end of the hippie dream. Yeah. And he looks at this also on All the Young Dudes. You know, my brother's at home with his Beatles and his Stones.
Yeah, it's
like, we're the new generation now, and this is where we are.
Did he write that then at that time? Was All the Young Dudes written about
it? It was written about the same time, because then he demoed it, and then Mott the Hoople took it. I think the Mott the Hoople hit, like the big hit, was 72, 73, but I could be wrong. Yeah. But it's something which keeps coming back. He keeps coming back to in his writing. Another thread which has been emerging in his work from The Man Who Sold the World is the occult, is the sort of the, these very dark references. You know, he was fascinated by Buddhism in the late 60s. There are lots of references to you know, Buddhist states of mind, and you know, the concepts of how we progress through our different stages and then die and reborn. Changes to me, and that's something that's also reflected in the music of Changes.
Like your Strange Fascinations.
Yeah, it has this at its heart. It's his first big anthem. And I'd be curious to know, what did you feel at the time, very tangible shift from the idealism of the 60s into the 70s?
I probably would be messing about with hindsight if I said there was. I didn't feel it at the time. Mm. What I felt at the time was that I was going to be a big rock star. So, you know, I'd been in two bands, both broken up because our gear got nicked. The bass guitarist in the second band I was in, the In-Betweens, which was multiracial, which was very unusual in 1967, West Indian guy called Sham, wanted me to start another band with him. I was stacking shelves in Tesco's, as was my day job. And I said, I've got to earn some money. I'm getting married. I got married when I was 18 to a single mother. And he said, he was a postman. Postman higher grade, which no longer exists. But he said, if you want to earn some money, come into the post office.
Right.
They can't recruit staff, so there's tons of overtime. Every time you work an hour at weekend, it's double time. So you can actually earn good money. So I thought, well, I'll do that temporarily till I could get some. I'd had a Hofner Very Thin nicked, was my guitar. Until I get some money together, get together with a few people and, you know, get back into music. And then the next thing, I'm moving the house out to Slough and the big council estate, but still writing songs. So I was writing songs a lot, particularly around this time. You know, I listened to Bowie because I thought he was an absolutely brilliant songwriter. To be able to write those songs, as you say, that filmic quality.
Yeah.
Life on Mars, you know, just the opening. It's Rick Wakeman on the piano, isn't it? Just that opening. It's a god awful small affair for the girl with the mousy hair, and then you're in. There's a short story here. Yeah. I mean, you know, although his lyrics do get a bit lazy, I think at times. Bowie, you know, he's even on that one.
Yeah.
Mice and their million horns from Ibiza to Norfolk Broads. Well, he kind of thought, what rhymes with hordes?
Norfolk Broads.
Yeah.
But if we think about it, it could be, I mean, Ibiza was a kind of very cool destination.
Yeah,
Norfolk
Broads
is not a very cool, it's where your grandparents would have gone, the Norfolk Broads.
That's true.
But Life on Mars, it feels cinematic.
Oh, the whole production.
The whole production, it's like...
And the orchestra, dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun.
And Mick Ronson, again, doing the orchestration there.
Yeah. And oh, did he?
He did the strings. He organised the strings on this. And then if you heard Transformer by Lou Reed, he did the strings on that as well. Yeah. The guy was such an underrated arranger and orchestrator. But this cinematic thing, like I said, is a theme that runs through, and you're right. Life on Mars, so it starts off the girl with the mousy hair, her mummy's yelling no, her daddy tells her to go, her friend is nowhere to be seen. So she goes to the cinema, and then it's all there on the silver screen.
Yeah.
And I've always thought it's overload of information.
Yeah, only some of them sound. Some of them sound sort of, you know, he is in a kind of bit of a hippie phase. But I'm just reminded of a song that's almost forgotten now that was my Bowie track when I did Desert Island Disc back in 2007 from Aladdin Sane, which is Drive-In Saturday. I mean, there's a story all there, including, you're talking about video. Now, I never heard the word video until that, and that must have been 74.
That was 73,
73? And Jagger, look into Jagger's eyes and
scored, like the video games.
Like the video games we saw.
And he says video games as well, which is not just a video recorder, but video games we saw.
Yeah, nobody ever talked about video. There was no video recorders. That didn't come for another 7-8 years.
Yeah.
End of the 70s. So it's almost as if, I mean, he had this obsession with space oddity, and then Oh You Pretty Things, Life on Mars, carried right through Starman, and then right sort of ended with Aladdin Sane.
And it carried on to Hello Space Boy.
And then
his final videos he did for Black Star. He knew that it was very unlikely he was going to be around for much longer. And so there's so, if you've seen the videos for Black Star and for Lazarus, they're full of, you know, things like Major Tom again, you know, on a distant planet somewhere, a dead line there. It's really chilling.
I just, because I was a great reader as well, and I read a lot of science fiction because my sister's first husband was a very big Dylan fan, when no one had heard of Dylan, because he loved folk music, Kingston Trio and all this. And there was a Dylan album, his first album. But he was also into Ray Bradbury and science fiction. So I started reading a lot of it. To me, the Bowie songs, like Life on Mars, like Driving Saturday, were like little science fiction short stories. But I guess that wasn't Bowie's influence. His influence was more the kind of ephemeral, kind of religious aspect of another world.
I don't know. I think you're right. I think he was a huge science fiction fan. If you look at Oh, You Pretty Things, he's talking about the coming race.
Yeah.
You know, and this Nick Pegg, who does the podcast as well sometimes, has said this refers to a writer, Bulwer Lytton, who was a 19th century science fiction author. And he was very big on the on this concept of, like, and it was a bit like Nietzsche, you know, like
Nietzsche
like
was like homo superior, wasn't
homo superior, yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like, there is a superior race coming. There is, you know, a clearing of the decks to make way for these people. And then for The Man Who Sold the World, he was totally obsessed with H.P. Lovecraft. As he admitted at the time, you know, when people said, "What on earth were those lyrics about?" He goes, "Oh, I read too much H.P. Lovecraft and smoked much too much dope, and then that's what happened."
So, combination of the two. Yeah.
Yeah. So he, yeah. I think
he did have his kind of flirtation with the far right, didn't he?
He did, and that comes up again here in Quicksand.
Yeah.
When it's kind of again revisiting this theme of Buddhism, belief, spirituality, something that Bowie always grappled with, but here in Quicksand he introduces some really dark. Yeah. References about Aleister Crowley. He refers to seeing the world through Himmler's eyes and then Churchill's lies, and it makes you wonder really where he's coming from in this. Later on in the mid-70s, and I think the drugs had a large role to play in this, his fascism, or his, well, his curiosity about fascism, let's say, certainly was sparked by this stage. And I think you know, he's always been, he's never shied away from exploring taboo subjects or ideologies which were quite dark.
Yeah, I hadn't realised he read so much science fiction. My problem is, I guess, I love reading, but I don't like reading about musicians, so I'm not really... you know, all the Beatles stuff, the Mark Lewison one is on the... One day I'll get round to the first one of that. Not ready yet. I've got it signed by Mark. We were at a book festival together doing a Beatles thing back... You know, I did one in Bath this year, but this was 4 years back at Cheltenham Festival. Because I was a director at Cheltenham, so for 1 year you get a chance to pick some items. And I said, let's do something about the Beatles. There was, as always, there was an anniversary. I forget which one it was. Mark signed a book for me, but I haven't read it. I read mainly fiction. And if I'm reading non-fiction, it's generally not about music. So all these music... I don't really know a great deal about... I'm not a musical journalist. I'm not an analyst of music. I just listened to it, so I hadn't realised the link with H.P. Lovecraft, and
it's subtle. I mean, it's not he's not shouting at it, but I think what's more interesting is the way all this stuff just kind of feeds in to what he's doing. I mean, if we stand back and look at Bowie as an artist, as a performer, he's very much a magpie, and he admitted that you know, in interviews throughout his life. He was like, well, you know, I'm not any one thing. I mean, you know, on the back cover of Hunky Dory, he refers to himself as the actor.
Yeah.
So I think this was the first album, really, where that cliche, that what would and become the cliche. And he'd
been through all that stuff with mime and art and all that. The problem for him was, I guess, I say this as a problem, because David Bowie always wanted to be, you know, a performer. He was always into the more avant-garde. So, but he wrote such devastatingly good tunes.
Yeah.
You know, Oh, You Pretty Things, All the Young Dudes, Changes, or just the hook of a line that would have made him a mint in Denmark Street, just writing pop songs.
I think that really came to fruition on this album.
Yeah.
And this album sounds the way it does because he started writing on piano. He was composing on piano for the first time. And so when he started demoing it, straight away his publishers picked up on Oh, You Pretty Things, and they gave it to Peter Noon.
Yes, of course.
And I think you're right. It's so astonishing just how he's leapt from... He didn't really do much musically on The Man Who Sold the World.
That's John, really, I'm Only Dancing. It's got a hook in there as well.
But he had that in him, ability. But I think on this album we see that fruition of the musician.
Yeah, yeah.
The fruition of the musician.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's amazing. I mean,
without tuition.
Without tuition. Hey, we got a poet! Something I wanted to talk to you about was you have kids and... Bowie wrote Kooks when his son was born. What was that experience like for you when you first had
a
child?
I liked it, yeah, I loved it, I loved it.
Because it
kind
of coincided when Jamie was very small.
Shall we stay in our lover's story? I like that song. Of course, Bowie would have consider that to be very lightweight stuff, you know, thrown away on the album. But I'm sure I'm not the only person who found that, you know, one of the most charming bits of the record. I was a bit, you know, I didn't imagine for a minute calling my son Zoe, but they were, or maybe Onsen Johnson or something.
Onsen Johnson.
But he did, I think he had the good sense to call him Duncan. Really. Yes. That was his proper.
Yeah. Well, I think it was Zoe Hayward, something Duncan.
Yeah.
And now he's Duncan.
Yeah.
But he went through a few.
But I like that. And I'd written a song, as I say in my book, on the day my son was born, because he was born at home. The midwives came and upstairs. This was the time when men were not welcome being anywhere near childbirth. But as they were in my house, I could have sort of insisted. But this lovely Irish matron, who was very, very experienced, just as well, because Jamie was born with a cord, the umbilical cord around his neck, she dealt with that brilliantly. But whenever I sort of suggested, I'd bring them up a cup of tea and then they'd push me out. So I went downstairs, picked up my guitar and started about 2 o'clock in the morning.
Right.
Welcome to your first day, my son. Now your journey really has begun. I really hope you like it on the train. You'll never see that waiting room again. And she heard me. And as I went up, she said, "No, do you not think you've got better things to do, Mr. Johnson, than plunking away on that old guitar?" And I thought, if I was Bowie, you know, writing Cooks, you know, she'd have gone out and bought it. But I was being derided for doing the same thing.
It does bring up a very, very nice mental image of Bowie in your position, sitting upstairs with a guitar and this lovely Irish person. Now, Mr. Bowie, if you're taking that, could be just something better than plinking on that big guitar. There's a funny little thing that stuck in my mind. He said he was listening to Neil Young that morning, and then when he got the call about the baby, he sat down and wrote Kooks. I always wondered, is there a sort of Neil Young thing to it? I think there's a slight, you know, when Neil Young does his more kind of winsome, sweet sounding songs.
Yeah.
There's definitely that about it. It's got that very jaunty.
Only Love Can Break Your Heart, that kind of stuff that he was doing on After the Gold Rush.
You were quite a big Neil Young fan, weren't you?
Young.
You said you like Crosby, Stills, Nash and Young. But...
Well, I like Neil Young and then listened to Crosby, Stills, Nash and Young because of the Young bit at the end.
So he was your kind of connection.
Linking with them. Oh, no. I loved Neil Young. And once again, that singer-songwriter era was thrilling for me. And then, of course, it all kind of went into glam rock. Although there was always someone worth listening to, you know, it didn't matter whether it was the glam rock era or whatever, there was always someone worth listening. You know, to me, I know Barry wouldn't agree with me on this because, as we were talking before, he wasn't a huge Beatles fan, big John Lennon fan in the end. But I referenced him because so many people, whether it's Paul Weller or whoever, Elvis Costello, they all point back to the Beatles as being their inspiration. And for me, because I lived through that period, I kind of don't think Bowie would have happened without the Beatles. I might be wrong, in the sense that writing your own songs, or maybe it would have happened later, or maybe Bowie would have been the breakthrough rather than the Beatles. But, you know, for this catalogue of songs, for this, you know, from Love Me Do to Strawberry Fields Forever in 4 or 5 years, I mean, it was an amazing, watching that huge evolution in popular music led to so many other things. But sadly, David doesn't seem to have been inspired by that. But then so many stars who came afterwards would have been inspired by Bowie, that's for sure.
Bowie went from this masterful hunky-dory album, he went into glam, he went into this apocalyptic doom rock of Diamond Dogs. He then does a complete about-face and becomes a Philadelphia soul boy on Young Americans. Then he does Station to Station, then he does the Berlin albums, and so on and so on.
My generation were growing up with that. My generation, to coin a term, you know, were growing up with that music and trying to reach... So I think that's an important part of it. You know, Lonnie Donegan might have inspired lots of people to pick up a guitar, but they weren't going to be singing My Old Mare's a Dustman. They were going to be playing the guitar and then suddenly listening. There was the Beatles, then in America, of course, the Byrds, the Beach Boys, Simon and Garfunkel, all trying to take this to a new level. So that evolution was continuing. And also pop music had become serious music. So the Times music critic, who only ever reviewed Shostakovich or Brahms or Beethoven, reviewed Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. Leonard Bernstein, said She's Leaving Home was equal to anything Schumann ever wrote. Suddenly, our music, me, I'm a teenager again, back in the 60s, was being taken seriously. And the fact that happened, I think, helped with that evolution as well. Always going to go a step further. And that extraordinary journey that the Beatles went on, right up till Sgt. Pepper. I mean, the White Album and Abbey Road and all that were great, but there was that rhapsodic period, Rubber Soul. How do we better that? Well, Brian Wilson actually...
That was the spur for
Brian
Pet
Wilson
Sounds,
was the spur
it?
For Pet Sounds. Then he heard Revolver and went into isolation for 15 years, you know? Wow, where's it? And then Sgt. Pepper's comes out and captures the mood of 67, Summer of Love so brilliantly. People ask me, what's the greatest time in pop, greatest period? Well, it's not the 60s for me, or the 70s, or the 80s. It's now. With the stuff that's coming out from bands and artists all over the world, drawing on that influence, plus you've got that back catalogue if you want to down. If you want to stick with Dire Straits' greatest hits, fine, you know, stay there. But if you want to move on, there's great John Grant out there that to me is an absolutely amazing artist. Everything, you know, Christine and the Queen says, just great
so
stuff
still,
happening all
you're
the time.
Still very, you keep an eye on what's happening, you still find music that
I love,
you enjoy.
I love pop music, and I've got no qualms about calling it pop music.
Yeah.
Whether to call it rock or whatever. It's important not to get too pretentious about it, you know. Pop music, and it's you know, it's life enhancing.
To wrap up with Hunky Dory, is there any one song on that album that says it all for you, takes you somewhere else?
Changes, I suppose. Changes. Every time I hear it, it's a thrill as it starts, and I can listen to it as many times. You know, you get sick of songs sometimes. You play to. I could never get sick of that. But I think it is the whole album. You know, I love the Andy Warhol thing from the first time I heard it. I loved Queen Bitch, which,
the America song,
which kind of took and took him into the next album, really.
Yes.
And you know, one of my few regrets in life is I wasn't at the Hammersmith Odeon when because that was kind of local place when we're
were you aware the gig was taking place?
Yeah.
You just couldn't make it.
Yeah, no, I couldn't make it when Springsteen was on at Hammersmith Odeon.
Right.
Well, we were only 30 miles up the road in the M4 in Slough, so it wasn't impossible to get to it. But that would have been some experience. And so I think, you know, it's the album as a whole. I think if you ask me about any other album, I'd pick out one song from it and say that was absolutely brilliant. Revolver, for instance, And Your Bird Can Sing, I've always said that is a standout to me. But on Hunky Dory, it's the thing as a whole. I mean, it was a remarkable record, and you kind of can't think about Changes without morphing into Oh You Pretty Things and then morphing into Life on Mars and morphing into
it's all of a piece.
Yeah.
Fantastic. Well, Alan Johnson, thank you so much today for sharing your thoughts about Hunky Dory. It's been an absolute pleasure talking to you.
Pleasure.
And best wishes with the book. I hope it goes well, and
thank you very much.
And that was Alan Johnson talking to me this summer about Hunky Dory. And I really do hope he's inspired you to pick up one or more of his memoirs. They're really an amazing and engrossing read. So I'd just like to thank Alan for his time and to Carolyn for organising everything. And Alan is actually currently touring the UK with readings from In My Life, details of which can be found at alanjohnsonbooks.co.uk. So if he's coming to a town near you, go check it out. He's a very, very entertaining speaker. In the meantime, I hope you enjoyed this edition. As usual, any feedback is welcome. Well, most feedback anyway. My ego's still quite fragile. Could I ask if you could share and recommend this podcast if you liked it? And if you didn't, well, if you could just keep quiet about it, that would be wonderful. Thank you. So, till next time then, listeners, all my loving and darling, I'll be true. Take care, and we'll meet again shortly.